All right, we're starting here on the bottom of Chav Gimel Amud Bet. Gemara is going to say, Rami derabbi Meir ad derabbi Meir, v'rami derabbonon ad derabbonon. We have a stira in the sheet of Rabbi Meir, and we have a stira in the sheet of the Rabbonon. Just to remind ourselves, we have a machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim as to whether an Eved has the ability to have independent ownership from his master. The Rabbonon, or more Meikil, who seem to have a leniency where he can, in certain circumstances, gain independent ownership. Whereas Rabbi Meir believes that he doesn't have that ability to gain independent ownership. Yesterday we saw the machlok between Rav Sheshet and Rabbi Elazar. Rav Sheshet said their machloket revolves around the question of he gives him ownership excluding his master. Whereas if he gives it for a specific purpose, everybody would agree that it's okay. Rabbi Elazar says that's exactly the machloket. When the monies are deemed for a specific purpose, the Rabbanan say it works, Rabbi Meir says it doesn't work. So now the Gemara says, we have a braita that says just the opposite, Titania. Eini shapuda maser sheni below chomesh. A woman does not redeem the maser sheni without a fifth. Bishim ben Elazar omer bishim Rabbi Meir. Shapuda maser sheni below chomesh. A woman can redeem it without a fifth. Gemara here is referring to the redemption of maser sheni. Maaser Sheni, when it's separated out by the Baalim, has to be taken up to Yerushalayim. In many instances, it was too far to take it up to Yerushalayim, so they would redeem it, meaning that they would exchange it onto money, take the money up to Yerushalayim, and then expend the money in Yerushalayim on food and certain items that you're allowed to buy within Yerushalayim with the monies of Maaser Sheni. There is a requirement. This is a requirement not only by Maaser Sheni, by Hekdesh as well. If you redeem Hekdesh, if it's your own property or it's your own maaser, we make the baalim, we make the owners add on a fifth on top of it. So if they redeem the maaser sheni, not only do they have to pay or redeem the maaser sheni, they have to add on one fifth. How you calculate the fifth, it's really a quarter. In the way that we speak about ratios, it's a chomesh milabar instead of a chomesh milagav. But either way, that is a specific necessity of the Baalim to add on a chomesh. If a third party redeems the Maaser Sheni, then you do not have to add on a fifth. You don't have to add on a chomesh. So if your friend is going up to Yerushalayim and says, do you want me to take your Maaser Sheni for you? So he pays you for the Maaser Sheni, redeems the Maaser Sheni, and it takes it up to Yerushalayim, then he does not have to add on a fifth. So here you have a machloket in the Braita that when a woman is doing the exchange, the redemption of the Maaser Sheni, does she have to add on a fifth, or does she not have to add on a fifth? The Tana Kama says she does not. B'Shimon Elazar, the name Rabbi Meir, says she does. Hey Chidami, what exactly is the circumstance here? Ilei mebizuzei debal. If she's using, the woman is using her husband's money, ubamaser debal, and it's his maaser sheni, shluchotei debal kaavdo. She's just an agent, an emissary of the baal, then it's no different than the owner buying it out. It's the owner's money. It's the owner's maaser. Just because she executes on it doesn't change the fact that he is redeeming the maaser sheni and would have to add on a fifth. Ella must be bezuzei dida umaser dide. The case where it's her money and his maaser. Right now we're using Rashi's girsa, which Rashi has the girsa, which is in the Gemara. In most cases, when Rashi changed the girsa in the Gemara also changed and follows or conforms to Rashi. But there are the many that argue on that, and we'll see in a second. Rashi over here says the case is bezuzei dida. What does that mean? Her money, benichsei malog. It's property that she brought into the marriage, nichsei malog, where she maintains the principal amount, but the husband owns the output, the production, the payroll from that field. Umaser dide, and the husband's maaser, meaning that it's his maaser sheni. Ish amar rachmano. The pasuk says ish et maasro, and so the Gemara learns ish mi maasro. The Gemara learns from the word ish below isha and not a woman. So now this is very interesting. We'll look in Rashi. Rashi says bezuzei dida nechse malol maaser dide mistoydotav ish amar rachmana below isha ish mi maasro amar rachmana below isha mi maaser bala de isha kacher damio, that a woman is considered to be a third party in this instance. She's like an outsider. Now, if you look down in the Bali et Tosafot, you can see here, Hachi Garcin and Rashi. He brings the quote from Rashi, and then he says, Vikasha le Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam does not understand what Rashi did over here. Deloaya lo laskir ish, v'isha klau. What does ish and isha have anything to do with this story here? El avalei the Meimar, The real drush over here is his maser and not his friend's maser. Ish v'isha are not relevant in this case because it's not only particular, this din, to a wife. This din is particular to any third party. And the answer is when it's ish mimasro, when you're redeeming your own maser, then you have the necessity to add a fifth. But if it's someone else doing it, including your wife, then they don't have to add on a fifth. Therefore, the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rabbeinu Tam, the Gorus, that they go back to the Girsa that Rashi changed. They go back to the original Girsa. Ela bezuze dida umaser dida. It's a case where it's her money and her maser. Well, if it's her money and her maser, then what's the question over here? Then she becomes the Balim and she should have to add on a fifth. The answer is, v'achi perusho, isha marachmana, demosif chomesh al maasro v'lo isha. That's exactly what the limud is. Ish below isha. Only a man adds on a fifth to his property when he redeems it, or the maser when he redeems it. A woman does not. Afilu bezuzei dida o maser dida. Even if it's her money and her property or her maser, even if she's an amana, she's a grusha, she's totally independent, she does not have to add on a fifth when she redeems it. That's the drosha. Ish below isha. Eno mosefet chomesh. And then he goes on to say, and in Torah Kohanim, where it says that, im gol yigal, that a woman does have to add on, or a woman is shayechet to this parsha, he says over here, the rabot isha le'inyan p'diya, that is to include the woman for the core redemption. The fact that she has the right to redeem it, that's what you learn out from im gol yigal. Whereas, as far as the chomesh is concerned, the woman is excluded. Why would you have a havamina that a woman could not redeem the ma'aser sheni? So the Rabbeinu Tam suggests it's because the pasuk over there says, the man tilmad, that when you go up to Yerushalayim with the Maaser Sheni, it's an opportunity to experience the Gdolim in Yerushalayim, to learn Torah, and so that there's an association between the bringing of the Maaser Sheni to Yerushalayim and learning Torah and Talmud Torah, which women are exempt from. So you would think that women also might have some exemption or not included in the Pidyon Maaser Sheni. So that's what the pasuk comes and says. Yes, they are included in Pidyon Maaser Sheni. They're just not included in the Chomesh. They do not have to add on that additional fifth. Whereas the Bali and Tosafot say that Rabbeinu Tam didn't have to go that far. You could have just said that since we have Ish, which comes to exclude Isha, we need a reboy to tell you don't make it the full thing. Don't say Ish v'lo Isha totally about Ma'aser Sheni, but rather Ish v'lo Isha is only about the Chomesh. As far as the Pidyon is concerned, the woman is included. So that's the way the Bali and Tosafot and the majority of Rishonim learned that the Girsa over here is her money, her maser. So then the only question is, what's the limud? The limud is ish velo isha, that a chomesh only applies to a man, not to a woman. On the other hand, Rashi, who changes that, says, and obviously is thinking, why should a woman who's the owner be excluded from a chomesh? It doesn't make sense. So the biggest question on Rashi is that the drusha that he really wants is ish mimasro, which is mimasro velo mimaser chaveiro. That's missing from the Gemara. Gemara is focused on ish v'isha. So what you have to say in Rashi, in essence, says that is that isha is just an example. It's saying here, in this instance, isha is kacheret. She's like a third party. So when it says ish velo isha, it means an ish and not someone else, not anybody who's not the owner, including his wife, who normally would be considered ishtoku gufo. Over here, she's deemed to be an outside party when it's her money. And so that's why the Gemara is focused on ish velo isha, not as man, not woman, but ish without his wife, because his wife is considered a outsider. It's considered to be an acheret, and that's how you have to explain it according to Rashi. So now, if that's the case, then here you have gzeira takatuf. So then, what is the question with regards to this machloket about whether the woman redeems it or not? El alav ki ay gavna. It must be that the instance here, or the circumstance here is, dakni la acher mane. A third party gave her money. Vamarla, amanat shetifdi bo et amaser. And if he says, you can use this money on condition that you use it to redeem the maaser sheni. So that's exactly the case that we just discussed, which is a case where a third party gave the eved monies and says, this is for your freedom, and only to be used for your freedom. There we had a machloket. Rabbanan said that works, and he can buy his freedom with it. Rabbi Meir says that doesn't work, and it goes, Mashikon Eved, Kana Rabbo, it doesn't work at all. Over here, we have the same case, it's just with the woman, where a person gives her money to the exclusion of her husband. He says this money, and he gives it with a particular purpose in mind. which is that you must use it for redeeming the Maaser Sheni. That's why I'm giving it to you. And over here, you would say, according to the Rabbanon, it should be that it should work. According to Rabbi Meir, it should be that it doesn't work. Look at the Braita. The Braita says, Eini Sha Puda Maaser Sheni below Chomesh. The Rabbanon say, it's as if her husband got the money, and she has to add on a Chomesh. Rabbi Meir says, she has independent ownership over here. She doesn't have to add on the Chomesh. It's the exact opposite of their opinions by Eved. Now you have by Isha. So Gemara says, Ipcho Shmeinelo. We heard their opinions just be the opposite. So I'm Rabbi Ipoch. In Ochanami, Abai says, flip the Braita. The positions in the Braita are backwards. And that Rabbi Meir is really the author of the Tanakama's position. And the Tanakama is really Rabbi Meir's position. And that would be consistent with the mission that we quoted before, or the explanation that we saw in Rabbi Elazar for the Sheet of the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Amar de Olam lo tipoch. Rabbi says, you don't have to flip it. V'ocho b'maser d'at b'inosho askinan. This is a case where the Maaser Sheni came from her father's house, meaning from the in-law's house, from her father's house. Rabbi Meir l'tameh. And Rabbi Meir's l'shita do, d'amar maser mamon hekdeshu. That maser really belongs to hekdesh, v'lo kani le'bao. And the owners never really own it. So here, in general, there are two approaches to hekdesh. In general, everybody agrees in certain cases, and there are areas in the middle which are gray. That is that sometimes when we partake of hekdesh, it belongs to hekdesh. It belongs to God. And mishulcha gomoa kozochinan. That we are really eating from God's table. The hekdesh and the items belong to God, but God gives us permission to eat from that. So for instance, the fact that the Kohanim get certain of the Kodashim, it can eat the Kodashim in the Mikdash, or the fact that they get the Bikurim, they belong to Hashem, they're really dedicated and given to Hashem, but Hashem invites them to eat from His table and to partake. There are certain things which are what we call Kodashik Bulin, Kodashim that do not end up in the Mikdash, certain things that are Kadosh, but their Tusha is specified for or designated for the particular individuals. So for instance, with Truma, Truma is something that you segregate out as Kedusha to it, but the Kedusha is designated for the Kohanim. We don't say that the Kohanim are eating from God's table. No, rather, the Truma is specifically designated when you separate it out for the Kohanim. So there are two models of Hekdesh in that way, or things that are Kadosh. One is that it belongs to God, but you partake. The other one is that it belongs to the party that you separated for, or you designated for. There are certain items that sit in the middle. Those are kodshim kalim. Those are things like maaser sheni, where maaser sheni has a requirement to be taken off in the gvulin, but be brought up to Yerushalayim. Kodshim kalim are brought up, but they can be eaten in anywhere in the city, not just in the mikdash. So in those areas, we find that there are machlokot between the tanaim as to what their status is. Are they mamon gvoa, or are they mamon balim? Are they the money of the owners? I mean, that really they still belong to the owners, and they just have to donate or give a certain parts of it to Hekdesh, and the remainder belongs to them. Or is it Mishulchan Gavoa Kazachinen? In essence, it's Kodshe Shamayim. They belong to God, and everything should belong to God, but God gives you an opportunity to eat from His table. It gives you parts of it. So one of those machlokot revolves around Maaser Sheni, which is right over here. Rabbi Meir L'tameh Damar Maaser Mamon Hekdeshu. He says, Maaser Sheni really belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's why you have to bring it up to Yerushalayim and eat it in Yerushalayim. Hashem just invites you to eat from His table, from His items in Yerushalayim. On the other hand, the Chachamim believe that the Maaser Sheni belongs as Mamon Balim, it belongs to you, and your only requirement is to bring it up into Yerushalayim to show or to experience being close to God, but it's still considered to be like Kodshei Gvul. And that will explain their difference of opinion over here. So when it comes from his father-in-law's house into his wife's hands, he does not acquire it because it's not money that belongs to them. It belongs to God. So when it belonged to God in his father-in-law's house and he passed away, now it comes to his wife, he doesn't inherit his wife. He doesn't take anything that comes into the hands of his wife because it's not his wife's either. It still belongs to God. It's maser, is mamon gavoa. Since it's mamon gavoa, the husband never gets his hands really on that because it's not a possession, it's not an item that belongs to you. Therefore, when you redeem it, you are a third party because it's not yours. Rabbanan l'tamayu damar mamon hejotu. Rabbanan believe that it belongs to the owners, and therefore it's like money. Any money that would come from the father's house to his wife would also be inherited by the husband. Mashe kana isha kana bala. V'koni le'bal, and therefore the Baal has ownership over here, and his ownership over here is enough to make it his. And if it's his, then he has to redeem it with the extra chomesh that's there. So that explained the difference of their opinions. Here, the question is not about the wife's ownership independent of her husband, it's simply about the status of Maiser Sheni. Is Maiser Sheni an inheritable object because it's money good, meaning that it's a Yerusha, or is it a non-inheritable item because it belongs to God, and you can't get possession of it? And that's the only question here. Rabbi Meir the Shitoto believes it's Mamon Gvoa. Therefore, the husband never gets his hands on it. He's always an outside party to it. Rabbi Chachamim believed that Maiser Sheni is Mamon Balim, and therefore he gets his hands on it, and that's why it's a problem over here. Hilkach Shlichuto de Baal Kavda. Therefore, if he inherits it from his father-in-law's house, when the woman then redeems it, she's acting as an agent of the Baal, because it's his. And now when she redeems it, her redemption of the item makes it that it's as if the Baal is redeeming the item. So that's the way that the Bayin Rova solved this stira between the bright about Maiser Sheni and what we saw before with regards to the Eved and his freedom. Right now, the Gemara moves on to the next piece of the Mishnah, which says that the Eved gains his freedom in certain manners. One of the things that's not mentioned in our Mishnah and is mentioned in the Braita is Tano. Yotzei b'shein v'ayin v'roshei v'rim sheinam chozrim. An Eved Kenani goes free if his tooth or his eye is knocked out by the Balim or any of the roshei avarim, the 24 avarim, which are mentioned with regards to Nigaim. Again, we'll get to them later on in the Gemara. If any one of those limbs is damaged by and rendered useless by the Baalim, by the Adon, then the Eved Kenani goes free because of that. So though the Rosh Hashanah have a common denominator, which we're going to see in a second, is that they are visible, items that are visible, items that when they are ruined, are permanently ruined and cannot be fixed, and they're something that's mevatalem mimelachto, that they can no longer do or function in the way that they functioned before. So if the Baalim do that, then the Eved Kenani goes free. Now, why does our Mishnah not mention this? So Tosfot points out, because our Mishnah believes, which we're going to see in one second, that you need to get shichur. It's not enough that the Adon knocks one of these Ibarim out, but he needs, in addition to that, to give a get shichur. So he doesn't see it as being a release mechanism, because it's only a partial release mechanism, not a full release mechanism, and that's why it's not mentioned in our Mishnah. But it is a vehicle for the release of an Eved Kenani. Bishlama Shein Vayin Ktivei. Shein va'ayin are explicit in the Pasuk. The Pasuk in Mishpatim says that with regards to an Eved Kenani, it says, V'chi yakeh ish et ein abdo, o et ein amato, v'shichata, d'chofshi yishalchenu, tachet einu. V'im shein abdo, o shein amato yapio, d'chofshi yishalchenu, tachet shino. So here you have two Pasukim, and they're explicit that shein va'ayin are grounds for him being dismissed or released. But where do you get the rest of the Evarim from? Shein v'ayin, I see. I don't see anything else. And that's what the Gemara says. Bishlam Hashem v'ayin k'tive. Ela Rashi Avarim min Alon. Where do we know the other limbs from? Dumya de Shein v'ayin. It's similar to Shein v'ayin. Ma Shein v'ayin mumim shibigalui. They are mumim that are exposed or things that you can see. Ve'inan chuzrin, and that is a damage that is done that is permanent. Afko mumim shigalui ve'inan chuzrin. So too, any exposed damage that is permanent and will not return to its previous function, they will have the same din as Shein V'ayin. So basically we're saying either it's a Gilui Milta, it's a Binyan Av, it's some sort of Limud from Shein V'ayin that teaches us that it's all of Ibrahim look like Shein V'ayin. Ve'ema, why do you say that? Navi Shein V'ayin k'shnei k'tuvim abayim k'echad. Let us say that Shein V'ayin are like two psukim that come to teach you the same thing. Whenever you have two psukim teaching you the same piece of information, they are not able to teach you more broadly. What that says is that we assume that anytime there's a law in the Torah, pasuk in the Torah, the assumption is that if the Torah tells you something, then you can use that as a paradigm. If the Torah gives you certain information, that becomes paradigmatic information. You can extrapolate that to whatever other halachot that you want. If the Torah tells you the same thing twice, instead of the item being a paradigm now, that tells you that's the exception to the rule. Because the Torah only has to tell you no if the answer would have been yes. I mean, if the default scenario would have been it's okay or yes, then when the Torah comes along and says no by two items, it's telling you these two are the exception, not the rule. Then if it tells you at once, it's establishing a rule. So the Gemara is using terminology, which obviously is not exactly perfect here to match. It's saying, look, anytime we have the Torah giving you two things, it means that's the exception, not the rule. Over here, if it gives you Shein and Ayin, let's look at it in that way. Shein by Ayin will be the exception, not the rule. Because otherwise, it should have just either written Shein or Ayin, and then I could have extrapolated from that paradigm. The fact that it gave you two items shows you that that's the exception, not the rule. So Tricha, that's not true. Because here, you would need Shein and Ayin. Shein and Ayin by themselves would not have taught you the din. Because Ikatav Rachman is Shein. If the Torah had only written a tooth, Hava Aminu Afilu Shein Techalav. I would have thought even baby teeth would have been included, but baby teeth do get replaced. If your baby tooth gets knocked out, the adult tooth comes in and replaces it. Had it just written Shein, I would have thought even if you knock out the baby tooth, there would have been reason or grounds for him being freed. Called of Rachman Ayin. That's why the Torah wrote Ayin, because that's something that is irreplaceable. Only get one. Called of Rachman Ayin. Had the Torah only written Ayin, Hava Mina Ma Ayin Shnei Vrayimo. Just like the eye is something that was created with him, meaning that he was born with it. Av Goshen Ivraimo. So to any things that are, he was born with. Av Shein, lo. But by Shein, where your adult teeth only come in later, you're not born with your adult teeth. Maybe there it would not be grounds for release. So I need Shein and Ayin because each one of them has an aspect to it that I need. And therefore, Tzricha. Since I knew both Sukkim, I can't claim now that they're the exception to the rule because they create the rule between them. They create the rule. Each one of them gives you a certain amount of information about the rule. One tells you that you don't have to be born with it. The other one tells you it has to be something that is permanent and will not be replaced. That means the baby teeth would not be reason or grounds for release, whereas adult teeth would be grounds for release. Sveima. So let us say it this way. Let's read the pasuk in this way. V'chi yakeh, which is the beginning of the pasuk. V'chi yakeh ish. So that is a klal. Shein v'ayin, then it specifies what you knock out, a tooth and an eye, prat, that is the details or specific information, that becomes a klal uprat. When I have a generic or general statement, then with a specific statement afterwards, ein b'chlal ala mashu b'prat. We learned this the other day. When it comes to a klal uprat, we view the prat as qualifying or defining the klal. When it gives you specific information, it tells you what the meaning of the klal was. What does it mean that when you hit the Eved and you do damage? Ain Shein V'ayin. That's what it's telling you. That's exactly what is the problem. If that's the case, Shein V'ayin in Midi Achrina Lo. That means that Shein V'ayin would be the only things that would result in a release. Anything else would not. So Gemara says, the Chofshi Yishalchenu Chazar V'Klal. Because it says afterwards, the Chofshi Yishalchenu, that is another Klal, it becomes a Klal Uprat Uchlal. In that case, Yatadan Elokein Aprat. Then you include things that are similar to the prat. The other klal helps you out because it was just a klal uprat, then the prat would define the klal. The next klal comes along to tell you, no, not that the prat defines the klal, but rather the prat defines the category which you will include by the klal. And that's what a klal uprat klal does. It's ka'ina prat. That's to be similar to prat. Just like over here, the specific items are something that is a visible damage and cannot be repaired. Once it's damaged, it's permanent. So too, any mum that is exposed and does not rehabilitate, they will be included. There's another common denominator between Shein V'Ayin, which is it stops him from doing the work that he did before. He's unable to carry out the same function as he did before. Before he could see, now he can't see out of that eye. Before he could eat, now he can't eat with the missing teeth. Alama Tanya, we have a brayta that says, Talash Bizkano, he grabs onto his beard and pulls on it, and it caused a dislocation or a breaking of the chin bone. Eved Yotzei Behem L'Cheirut. The Eved goes out free based on that. So then, if that's the case, why is that true? Because, yes, it's a Mum Shibigaloi. Yes, it is in a Chuzrin. Problem is, it's not Batel Mimalachto. What did he do before that he can't do now? His chin is not something that's a functional part that he uses in terms of eating, seeing, smelling. I mean, that's not one of the functional parts of the body where there's a specific malacha associated with his chin. The teeth before were functional in eating. Now he can't eat because the function that has been lost over here. I mean, that the chin is not a functional aver. supposed to one's hands, eyes, teeth, but these are all limbs that provide a function, and the function is ruined once that aver is damaged. So the Gemara answers something which is amazing. It says the chofshi shalchenu ribuyahu. It says the chofshi shalchenu is really a ribuy. So now, what does that mean? The way Rashi seemingly describes it over here is that the Gemara just jumped tracks, which is that the Gemara has two methods of drasha, which we already saw before, which is klal uprat to klal, uribuy umiut uribuy. So now, what the Gemara was doing until now was saying that we're on the track of klal uprat to klal. That ran us into a little bit of a dead end because it didn't include enough things. So what the Gemara says is, no. It's a riboy miut uriboy. And once you have riboy miut uriboy, riboy says, I'm a rabbi at a kol. The miut says I exclude one item. But basically I include everything. So if that's the case, now I've changed tracks. And I have riboy miut uriboy. Riboy miut uriboy is a much more inclusive type of riboy. And therefore it can include items. There are a number of problems with that. Number one is that riboy miut uriboy would include much more than I think we even want to include. Because then you don't have to have all these specifications. It has to be a mumshi begaloi, that it has to be something where it's eno chuzer. All those may not be necessarily governed by riboy miut uriboy, because riboy is riboy et hakol. Miut is just mayit, one item. So that one item, you could decide what it is, but it's not going to be mayit, all the things we said before. That's one problem with it. Number two is, generally, whenever we have a methodology of drasha, the Gemara stays consistent with that drasha. Meaning that there are different schools of thought. But to jump tracks in the middle of the Gemara here and say, oh, we were thinking this school of thought and we moved over to that school of thought, unusual. You never see that in the Gemara. We have people arguing about how to look at this or how to be Dorishit, but we never have people jumping tracks in the middle. The last thing is that the Gemara over here should have said Ella. Ella is an indication, a transition word that tells you we are rejecting the previous statement and we're moving on to something new. That doesn't happen over here. There's no Ella. L'chavshi shalchenu ribuya. Ella, you got it wrong until now. It was klal uprat to klal. Now we should move over to ribuya to miyu. It seems to be continuing with the same process of thinking. It doesn't have an Ella in it. So now what you have to suggest then is that yishalchenu ribuya who has to do with something that we saw in the Gemara Nazir, which is that a klal uprat to klal. When you have a klal uprat to klal, you have two klalalim. You have a klal in the beginning and you have a klal at the end. Which one of the two klalim is the primary klal? Is it the klal in the beginning that's the primary klal? Or is it the klal in the end that is the primary klal? And we saw in the Gemara in Nazir that it made a difference. That we would be more apt to include more items if the latter klal is the primary klal versus the first klal. That is because look at the build up here. If you think of it as the first klal being the primary klal, then it's a klal uprat. What you started out was a klal and a prat. When we have a klal prat, the prat defines the klal. Then you have the second klal that comes and says, don't do that. Be mirabe kein a prat. So that means that your underlying or base, which you started from, was a klal uprat. Then you added on a klal at the end to say, include a little more than that. On the other hand, if you learn that the basis is prat uklal, that's the base, that's the foundation, it's a prat uklal. Then when you have a prat uklal is very similar to a klal uprat uklal. It's almost identical to a klal uprat uklal. It might be just more minimized. Then when you say that the additional klal is the first klal, then you would include even more than you normally would include. So that means it depends on which one is the core klal or the foundation that you're building upon. Could be that it's a prat uklal, and now we're saying we're adding on a klal in the front. Or you could say that it's really a klal uprat, and I'm adding on the klal in the back end. The difference between them would be how much you are mirabeh, how much you would include. It's much more expansive to say that the fundamental klal is the second klal. To say prat uklal, which already is inclusive, and then to add another klal would make it even more inclusive. Whereas if you start out with a klal uprat, then the first klal is the foundation or the fundamental klal, and then you add on the second klal, that second klal will include much less because the fundamental foundation is something that is much more restrictive. So that's maybe what the Gemara is saying over here, that's suggested by some of the Rishonim, that it's saying here that the klal batra is the primary klal. That the second klal was the original klal. So it's not that we say, v'chi yakeh, klal, shein v'ayin prat. And then we say, oh, now you're stuck. And then we go, no, the shachenu chavshi gives you the other klal. It's the other way around. Shein v'ayin is the prat. Then the chavshi shachenu is the klal. So now I have a prat to klal. I should include almost everything. Gemara says, no, it's really a klal to prat to klal because I have a klal in the beginning, b'chiyake. So I'm learning the other way around. I'm giving the primacy to the second klal, which means that I'll be merabim much more, even in the school of thought of klal uprat to klal. So that's something just to know. It depends which klal is the anchor versus which one is the additional klal. Second klal is the anchor. It is a much more inclusive klal uprat to klal. And that might be what the Gemara is suggesting over here. So chavshir shchenu ribuyuhu, I mean, that's the focus, that it's much more merabe because it's focused on that second klal. V'iribuyuhu, afili kalo yadol b'tzamta. Well then, if you're going to make it into a ribuy, now whether according to Rashi that means ribuy miyot to ribuy, or according to us now means that we're including it as the second klal as the primary klal, then if you hit him on his arm or his hand, and it shrivels up, the soul will absorb, but it will recover, it will recuperate. Nami, that should also be considered an item that sets him free. Alama Tanya, why do we have a bright that says he kolo yodo b'tzamta, hits him on his hand or his arm, and it shrivels up, it dries out, the soul will absorb, but it will recuperate, it will heal. Ain't even yotze ba the chirut. So it says, imkein, shein vayin, mayanile. You have to exclude something, meaning that if you're going to include everything, then what does shein vayin do for you at all? Why do you need shein vayin at all? So the answer will be, again, when you're talking about ribuy and miyot to ribuy, it's a little harder to explain this, because generally when we have those items in the middle, shein vayin, each one of them would exclude one item. So now maybe that's what the Gemara is saying, it excludes this one item, an item where, if it's going to heal, then you don't worry about it. When you use it as klal prat to klal, then it's kein a prat. The only question is, how close or how tight to the prat are we? So that's what the Gemara says, shein vayin is still an anchor over here, it's kein a prat. Just a question of how much we include. Do we include a case even where he pulls the beard and dislocates the chin? The answer is yes. Does it include a case where it's going to recuperate? The answer is no. I mean that's Kena Prat. You have to be similar to Shein V'ayin. May not be exactly like Shein V'ayin, but at least similar to them. And that's what Shein V'ayin do for you over here. Just to know that there are other shitot here with regards to this, the Rambam seemingly thinks that the problem with the jawbone is that it's not should be galui. It's not exposed. Because the beard covers it over, and therefore it's not something that's visible, the dislocated chin. Others suggest that the chiddush over here is the fact that when the chin bone is broken, it does affect the ability to chew, meaning that the jaw and the function of the jaw is affected, but it's different than the other cases before. The other cases before, the knocking out of the tooth causes a problem with eating because the tooth is the direct limb, or it's the direct bone that is used in the eating. The other hand, when you break the chin, it affects the eating, but it's an indirect effect because you did not hit directly the functional part that does the eating. It's something that is either ancillary or connected to eating. So it affects the ability to eat, but it's not directly the item that is doing the eating. So maybe over there in those cases, you would have thought that it wouldn't be a problem and it wouldn't be an issue. That's what the Kamash Malana is, that even though it is once removed from the function that it causes a problem for, it still is a problem. And you can see that in the Tosfot Rei HaZaken, because he says over here, Afal gav debein en mumim shebegalui, hari batel maseh shinayim akvuim bo shuever galui. So you see that from here, that, v'chein kadav Rambam, shari batel maseh shinayim akvuim bo to etzem. So he explicates on the Rambam, who seems to say that the problem here is that the chin is not a visible etzem, but it has impact on something that is visible. So that derivative impact is what the Gemara is saying over here is the problem, even though the item itself is not galoi or not a direct impact on the function of eating. All right, so those are just ways to view what the issue is with the broken bone over here and why we would consider it to be problematic, even though it seems somewhat distant from a loss of function. Bukulam, in all these cases, meaning that these cases where the eved goes free, when the adon hits him and damages him, eved yotzei b'hem l'cherut. In all these instances, means all these 24 everim, he goes free. V'tzarich get shichrur divi Rabbi Shimon. Rabbi Shimon says it's not enough that the Torah gives you that freedom. You need a get shichrur. You need a document of emancipation to corroborate. Rabbi Meir says you do not need a document of emancipation. Rabbi Lazar Omer tzarich. Rabbi Lazar says you do need a document of emancipation. Rabbi Tarfon Omer, enu tzarich. So you have here machloket of multiple tanaim, and so whether you need a get shechrur in this case or not. I would suggest that the machloket revolves around what exactly does the damaging of the shein ba'ayin or any of the other limbs do in terms of the freedom of the slave. We have to remember that the slave is comprised of two parts of ownership that the Adon has over him. He has a monetary ownership over the slave, and he has an Iser ownership over the slave. Remember that we learned this in Gitin, that if you mafkir the slave, he still needs a get shikrur, because then you've only released the monetary ownership, you haven't released the Iser ownership that you have over the slave. And what might be the machloket here between the Tanaim is how we view the damaging of the shein v'ayin as a means for release. Do we say that he knocked out his tooth, he knocked out his eye, and he really should be compensating him for that? He has to make remuneration over the fact that he damaged his eye or his tooth. Instead, the Torah gives him his freedom. So basically what it's saying is, in lieu of the monetary recompense for these items, we're going to allow you to go free. If that's the case, then this is simply a monetary consideration, and he was freed monetarily. But that doesn't mean that the Isur was released, and that's why you would need a get shichrur. On the other hand, if you view the Torah's release of the slave in these cases as being not simply monetary remuneration to the slave, but a knas, it's a penalty to the Adon for treating his slave improperly, that penalty is he goes free. So in that case, the freedom would be a full gain freedom. It wouldn't just simply the monetary release, it would be a release even of the Isur. In that case, you wouldn't need a get shichur. So I just suggest that maybe that's the difference in the thinking of the Tanaim here as to what is behind the release because of the shein v'ayin. Is it simply a monetary consideration? Then you would have to add on a get shichur on top of it. Or is it a knas or a penalty, and therefore it's a complete release of the eved? So amachrim lifnei chachamim omrim, those that are the decisors in front of the chachamim say, nirin divrei Rabbi Tarva b'shein v'ayin. Rabbi Tarvin's position makes sense when you're talking about shein v'ayin. Sure, Torah zachtalo. The Torah gave it to him, granted him the right. V'divrei Rabbi Akiva b'shar everim. Whereas for Rabbi Akiva, by the other everim, ho v'knas chachamim ho. Because it's a knas chachamim, it's a penalty of the chachamim. And when it says, knas ho? What are you talking about? It's not a penalty. Kraika darshina. We just had a drusha directly from the pasuk. This is a din d'oraita. Shein v'ayin is written in the Torah. The other everim came out of a lumud that is associated with that pasuk. That's also a d'oraita. That's not a din d'rabbanan. El hoyo umidrash chachamim ho. Because it's a drusha of the chachamim. This leads to a huge tumult amongst the Rishonim here, because it makes no sense. Which is that, generally, when we view something that's written explicitly in the Torah, that's called d'oraita. The chachamim use one of the shlosh esrei midot, the Torah, to be nidrash behen. That's also considered to be a din d'oraita. All of a sudden here, the Gemara is differentiating between these two mechanisms of d'oraita. In one case, it's calling it a d'oraita. The other case, it's calling it a midrash chachamim. Why is that? Why should there be any difference between the two? They should both be dinim d'oraita, and there should be absolutely no difference between them. And so for that reason, you can see in the Tosafot, Rabbeinu Tam here raises the issue, and right away, that all the Rishonim ask, Mim Tomar, Umabakach, Ho Midrash Chachamim Hu, Halo Kama Gufei Torah Tzvuyim, Shein Ba'in El Mikoach Drasha. So much of our Torah and all the laws that we keep come out of Drashot, that are Doraita. They're not directly written in the Psukim. V'chein Nira the Rabbeinu Tam. So Rabbeinu Tam gives two answers here. T'ged Zeh Inu El Midrabanan. Now, the question here is not a release d'oraita. In both instances, you are released d'oraita. There's no question that you are free mid'oraita. The problem is that when this slave goes free because of this, he's going to be walking around the shuk, and his master's going to come back and say, you're mine. You're my slave. And will people stop him from taking the slave back? Well, that depends. If his eye or his tooth was knocked out, then everybody knows that's written in the Torah explicitly. They know that that's a means for freedom, and they will stop the Adon from taking him. On the other hand, when it comes to the Evarim, that's a drasha that not everybody is familiar with. Since not everybody's familiar with it, they'll let the Adon re-exert his ownership over the slave. So we make him give a get shichrur in order that people don't make that mistake. So that's what the Rabbeinu Tam says, that by the case of Roshei Evarim, excluding Shein V'ayin, we make him give a get shichrur midrabanan. And that's what it means over here. That because it's a midrash chachamim, it's not well known. Cases where the drush is not well known, we have the rabbanan say, give him a get shichrur, so it doesn't get forgotten, or people don't make a mistake and think that he really belongs or still belongs to this adon. So that's one way that he deals with the issue. And we have other examples of this in Shas, where people are not familiar with the drasha, and there the Chachamim institute something to make sure that it's obvious that this is the halacha, or the halacha is maintained this way. Before we read the second answer of Tosafot, I'm just going to read on in the Gemara a little bit, because it's built on the next part of the Gemara, which is my time at the Rabbi Shimon. What's the reasoning behind Rabbi Shimon, who says that you need a get shichrur? Yalif shiluach shiluach misha. He learns out, it says here, the chofshi yishalchenu, and by the woman it says v'shulcha, mibeito, that she's sent out of the husband's house. So they have shiluach shiluach, ma isha bishtar, av evin nami bishtar. The release of a woman happens through a get, so too an eved can only be released through a shtar. So that's it. It's probably not a real gzeir shavo. It's either a gilui milta or some sort of limud of association, not a gzeir shavo, because these words are used in each case for specific drashot, both by an eved and by an isha, so they're not really available for gzeir shavo. So it's probably more trying to say this is the definition of shiluach. When you send someone out by a woman, the definition of sending her out means she gets a get. So do by an eved. When it says you send him out, it means that you have to give him a get shichrur. Rabbi Meir, ikot tov chofshi lebesov kedamart. If it wrote chofshi in the end, I would agree with you. Since it says chofshi first, therefore it governs, which is, it says over here, v'chi akei ish et ein abdo et ein amato, v'shichata, and he destroys it. Lechofshi yishochenu. It doesn't say yishochenu chofshi, send him out free. It says he's free, therefore you send him. So the freedom is what comes first. That's defining the sending. The sending is because he's free, not he's sent to be free. And therefore he says that the freedom comes without a get shichrur. So now what the Riva answers is, that's the difference between Roshei Averim and Shein Va'ayin. Shein Va'ayin is learnt out of the explicitness in the Pasuk. It says, Ein abdo u ein amato, v'shichata lechofshi yishalchenu. That means that the chofshi is modifying Shein V'ayin and say that you go free because of Shein V'ayin. On the other hand, where did we learn out the other Evarim from? We learned it out of Eklalu Pratuchlal, the Riboy Miyot Riboy. What's the second Riboy? The chofshi Yishalchenu. The word Yishalchenu was the Riboy for the other Evarim. Now, if the Riboy for the other Evarim is Yishalchenu, that means that the word chofshi does not appear before them. Because the word Yishalchenu includes them, that means that the word chofshi is not associated or not before that. And that's why it'll be different. It's a very interesting, it's a very nice drasha, which is that Shein V'ayin are governed by the fact that the word chofshi comes before Yishalchenu. But in the case of the other Evarim, they are learnt out of the word Yishalchenu. So therefore the word chofshi is not even associated with them. It's the word Yishalchenu that is associated with them. And therefore, Yishalchenu is defined by the Yishalchenu of the woman, which says that you need a get shichrur. And for that reason, we would differentiate between the nature of these drashot. What's written explicitly is governed by chofshi. The word is learned out of the word Yishalchenu is not governed by the word chofshi, and therefore you require a get shichrur. So in Ochanami, they're both d'oraita according to the Riva, but their limud, or where they're learned from, makes a difference, because in the pasuk, where they're located, has impact, because of this difference between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Meir's opinion. According to Reino Tam, everything is though right over here, there's no difference between them whatsoever, just an imposition derabanan. There are those that say that we take this Gemara literally. If you remember, we saw this with the Rebbeim of Rashi, with regards to Kiddushim. But the Gemara say with regards to Kiddushim, that Shtar and Bia are d'oraita, and Kesef Kiddushin is midrabanan. Everybody, Rashi goes crazy. How could it be derabanan? It's a drasha d'oraita. It's something that's learned out of the Torah. How could you call it a derabanan? They are basically relying on this Gemara over here that says that when something is midrash, mina Torah, it's called a midrash chachamim. It's not called a d'oraita. Now, whether that midrash chachamim is different than a regular derabanan, is all likelihood the answer is yes. That it's different, but it still doesn't have the full-fledged status of a din d'oraita. And that is what the Rebbeim of Rashi suggests, and it might even be the sheet of the Rambam. The Rambam used terminology that's similar, and he also brings down a sheet that seems to be similar to the Rebbeim of Rashi. And it seems that it's premised on this Gemara over here, that you can differentiate in d'oraita between things that are explicitly written, and things that are nidreshet mishloshes reha midot, that they're called midrash chachamim. Again, it may not be that it's not d'oraita, but it might be a lower form of d'oraita. Or it may not be that it's exactly d'rabanan, it might be a higher form of d'rabanan. But it still has a different status than a d'oraita that's written explicitly in the psukim. Right now, the Gemara continues, next braita. Tarabanan, hikyahu aleino v'sam'a. He hit him on his eye, and he blinded him. Alozno v'charsha. or he hit him on his ear, and it caused him to be deaf. Eved yotzei b'hem lechirut. This is grounds for him to be released. These are roshei avarim. He did damage that is permanent, and mevatel mivlachto. It's no longer functional anymore. You can't see out of that eye. You can't hear out of that ear. Neged eino v'eino ro'eh. If he hit him, now here, it sounds like from the Braita that he hit him like on his cheek. And that causes his eye to lose sight. But the way the Gemara you'll see in a second learns it is that he hit the wall next to him. He smacked the wall next to him, and he lost his sight because of that. Kenegados, no, he smacked the wall next to his ear, and Eino Shemen, he lost his hearing because of that. Ein Eved Yotzei Ben Lecherut. And Eved does not go free because of that. So here you see that you need to have the damage be done by a directed hit to the Aver that is damaged over here. If it's done as a grumma or an indirect manner, that's not grounds for release. It's not just because you caused them to be dysfunctional. Is that a grounds for release? It means that you have to actually damage that particular Aver and therefore cause it to no longer be functional. Amar Rav Shemin the Ravashi. Lememra, the Kala Lav Klumhu. You're saying over here that noise or some loud sound is not considered to be damage. Because he hit the wall next to his eye or his ear and it caused damage, you're saying that, oh, that's not a problem? Avatani Rami Brachesko, we have from the Gemara in Baba Kama, Tanagol, Shoshit Rosho, Lavir Klezuchuchit. If a Tanagol sticks its beak, its head, into a glass utensil, Vitakabo, he squawked inside of it, Vishabro, and he broke it, Mishalim Nezak Shalim, he has to pay for it. So you see here, even though the chicken never touched the clay, and he simply made a loud noise, he squawked inside of the clay, that's grounds for making you culpable. Vamar Rav Yosef, Vamar Bei Rav, Sus Shitzanaf, a horse that neighs, V'chamor Shinier, or a donkey that brays, V'shavru Kelim, and they damaged utensils, V'toch Abayit in the house, V'shamim Chatzi Nezek, you have to pay for half the damage of them. Sometimes do with a machloket about what's called Srorot. In the Gemara in Baba Kama, it's a machloket between Sumkos and the Chachamim. Srorot are when the animal, in its normal course of what it does, sends off a projectile. So for instance, it's walking down the street, and it shoots a stone out from under its foot. If that stone does damage, that's called Srorot. It's not its koach, it's not its direct, but it's koach sheni, or koach to koach. It's a derivative of its strength or of its movement that causes damage. That, the Gemara says, Alocha Moshe Misinai, that Srorot are Chayavin. Sumcho says that you're Chayav Nezek Shalem. The Chamim say that you're Chayav Chatzi Nezek. So what the Gemara is saying is that these sounds by these animals are considered like Srorot, because they are a derivative of the Koach of the animal. And here, why do you pay Nezek Shalem in one case and Chatzi Nezek in the other case? Is because one of them is authored by Sumchus, who says that you're Chayav Nezek Shalem. One of them is authored by the Chachamim, who say that you are Chayav Chatzi Nezek. So anyway, that's why it's Nezek Shalem and Chatzi Nezek. But the main point is that sound that is generated by an animal, you are held culpable for. So why isn't a person held culpable for smacking the wall or making a loud noise next to this individual in the same manner? Samalei Shani Adam. To Kevin the Bardatu, Iu Mivit Nafshe. Very interesting concept. The Gemara says that since a human being is a thinking, knowing being, therefore the damage was caused to himself. The fear that he experienced, or his reaction to the noise, is what caused the damage. It's not the noise itself. It's not the smacking of the wall next to him that did it. It's the fact that it's his reaction to it, or the way that he dealt with that noise that caused the problem. Kedetanya, Hamavit et chaveiro, patur midinei adam v'chayav bidinei shemaim. Person who scares his friend, and in scaring his friend causes damage, he is not held accountable in Beit Din, in laws here. He is accountable bidinei shemaim, either because it's grama, or it's clear that there's a correlation between what he did and the damage that he caused, but it's still not direct damage. And since it's not direct damage, he's not held culpable in Beit Din for that. Ketza, takabels no, v'charosho. Made a loud noise by his ear, and therefore caused him to go deaf. Patur, achzo. On the other hand, if he held onto him, and he made a loud noise in his ear and caused him to go deaf, then he is chayav. Now, you can view this in one of two ways. You can view it as that when he made the loud noise, the other person could have moved away or moved his head. But when he holds in place, he prevents that from happening, and that's why he's held culpable. Or you can say that in the case where he's not holding him, there's no direct contact between the mazik and the nizak, and that's why he's patur. The case where he holds him, there is a direct contact between the mazik and the nizak, and that's why he's held accountable. But either way that you frame it, he will only be chayab b'dinei adam when there's direct contact and he stops the individual from escaping the damage that is there. So that's the reason why in the case of hitting the wall next to the eved and causing that damage, he doesn't go free then. Because in any form of nezek, in nezakim in general, that's not considered to be direct nezek. Since it's not direct nezek, then you're not held accountable. If you're not held accountable, he's not going to go free in that case for that type of damage. All right, so now the Gemara says, Tarabanan, hikaleinu v'kahata. He hit him on his eye, and then he caused the eye to dim. He didn't lose his sight completely. He just reduced his vision. Alshino v'nadada. He knocked his tooth, and now his tooth is loose, but it did not come out. Im yachol ishtamesh ben akshav. If they are still functional and they still work, then ein eved yotzei ben lecherut. He doesn't go free. Vim lav. They're no longer functional. Eved yotzei ben lecherut. Tanya idach. We have another brayta. Hareishai dayino kuya. What happens if his eye is already dim? I mean, he doesn't have perfect vision. He has limited vision. Visam'a. And then he blinds him completely. Shino neduda. His tooth is loose already. Ve'pila. And he knocks it out. Im yachol ishtamesh ben kvar. If beforehand they were functional, then when he knocks them out, eved yotzei ben lecherut. He goes out free. Vim lav. If he couldn't use them beforehand, and eved yotzei ben lecherut. Then the eved does not go free. V'tzricha, we need both of these cases. What it's saying is that if you take him from fully functional down to less functional, then he doesn't go free. If you take him from partially functional down to zero, he will go free. What it's saying in the essence is that when it's still functional or partially functional, that's not enough of a reason for a release. And it's considered as if he still has those items in function. And therefore, if you ruin them, you're going to be held accountable. If you only told me the first one, Mishum Dimi Kara Nahora Barrio, in the beginning he had clear vision. And now you have reduced his vision. So therefore, that's why you are held accountable or why he goes free, because you took him from fully functional down to partially functional or to a point where it can't do what it was before. Over here in the second right, where it's already a damaged good before you got there. Aim alone. Maybe you wouldn't go free because of that. Ha. If you only told me the second brayta, mishum desami legamrei, because you made it totally unusable now. Avahatam desami legamrei over there, we didn't make it totally unusable. Aim alone. Maybe over there you would not go free for it. Tzricho, that's what tells you you do go free. Meaning that there are two versions of damage that can take place over here. There's one form of damage which is you reduce it down from its fully functional state to a lower state of function where it can't function the way it did before. That means that he's unable to do the things he did before. If he can still eat, even with the loose tooth, then you haven't changed what is going on, even though you made his tooth loose. On the other hand, if his tooth is so loose that he can't eat anymore, even though you didn't knock it out, it's the equivalent of you knocking out his tooth. On the other hand, the other way around, if his tooth is loose but it's still functional, then if you knock it out, you've done enough damage that he would go free. If it wasn't functional before and you knocked it out, then you haven't done anything incremental enough that he goes free. But that shows that partial damage will have to be assessed by the function that is still available with that limb. Tanrabanan, Haresh Ayara Borufe. His master was a doctor. Vamarlo, Likholo Eno. The slave asked his doctor master to put some sort of salve on his eye to cure his eye. Visama. And in his treatment of him, he ended up blinding him. Lachdor lo shino, his master was a dentist. And then he says, listen, can you drill my tooth? Can you take care of my tooth? V'pila. And he knocked it out. He ruined the tooth. Sichek badon. This guy can laugh as his master. V'yatzeh lechirut. And he goes free. So basically what he did was the master was trying to do it for his own good. He was helping him. He asked the master to treat him in the capacity as a doctor, as a dentist. And for whatever reason, something went wrong. And he ruined the tooth. He ruined the eye. The Eved can say, even though you didn't do it intentionally, but I'm going, I'm out of here. You ruined my tooth, you ruined my eye, I'm free. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, v'shichata. The pasuk says, v'shichata, ad shi'ikavein l'shochata. He has to have intent to damage it. Over here, he has no intent to damage it. When he's working with the eye or the tooth, he's trying to fix it. He's trying to do good for them. He's not trying to ruin it. V'shichata, says the pasuk, means that he has to have intent to hurt or to destroy it. If he hits him, that's one thing. If he's trying to cure him, that's another thing. So Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says he doesn't go free with this. V'rabbanan v'ay shichata mayavdile. The chachamim, what do they do with shichata? We buy a look at the Tanya. They need it for this braita. If he's a doctor again, he's in OBGYN. He sticks his hand into the uterus of his shivcha knanit. And in doing so, he blinds the fetus that is inside there. Patur. Over there he is patur, and he doesn't go free. My time amakra v'shichata. The pasuk says v'shichata, ad shikavein l'shachata. Till he tends for damage. Be'idach, and where does Rabbi Shimon Gamliel learn that out from? Mishichet shichata. Because it could have said mishichet, since it says mishichata, so you have two limudim, nafka, be'idach, and chamim, shichet shichata lo darish. They don't think that's significant enough to make a drasha out of it. The question you have to ask is, what's the difference? For the chachamim, why, when he's an OBGYN and he works with the fetus, that's not considered to be intentional? Yet when he's a doctor, a dentist, that is considered to be intentional and does get him the freedom. So either you have to frame it this way, which is that when he's working as the dentist or the ophthalmologist, in that case, the ayin and the shein are there, they already exist, and then he knocks them out. Whereas by the ubar, who's not born yet, it's not considered to be a shein or an ayin yet. And therefore, when he does the damage, he really didn't damage a shein and ayin because they haven't been. They're not a shein and ayin yet because the baby hasn't been born. That's one way to formulate the difference between them. Or you have to formulate the difference between them in this way, which is, what is he working with? I mean, that in the case of Shane Ma'ayin, he is working on the eye and then causes the damage to the eye. In the case of the dentist, he's working with the tooth and he causes damage to the tooth. In the case of the OBGYN, he's working with the fetus in general. He didn't even intend for the eye whatsoever. He was trying to help her out. He was shifting the baby, whatever he was doing to help her out. When he poked out the eye, he was not specifically engaged in working with the eye. And therefore, for the Rabbanan, that's already considered to be too far away or not intentional damage. So for them, it might be the equivalent that we find in the Melachot of Shabbat, the difference between Mita'asek and Enu Mitkaben. Finally, between where you don't intend for it at all, or Mita'asek, you're involved, but you didn't intend for this to happen. So it might be that same difference, which is you're somewhat more removed in a case where you have no intent for this whatsoever, and you happen to bump into it or bump into the eye. The other case, when you're engaged with the eye, but you didn't intend to damage the eye, but you're already involved, you're working with the eye, and that's why the chachamim holds you culpable when you're the ophthalmologist and the dentist, but not when you're the OBGYN who damages the eye, because he wasn't working with the eye. It happened to be by accident or something happened. That's already far enough away from intent, that's not considered intent. But if you're already engaged with the eye and the tooth, that's enough intent because you're working with them. It doesn't mean you have to intend to destroy them, simply that you intend to work with them, and that's enough. And that'll be the difference between the Chachamim's position in the Braita versus what Rabbi Elazar says in the Braita over here. The Ubar, who when born would automatically be a slave, if you said that that damage to the eye was enough grounds for him to be freed, then he would be freed. When he's born, he would be free because the Adon already knocked out his eye. Rabbi Sheshit, Harai Chaitaino Smuya. What happens if he was already blind? V'chatata. And then the Adon took the eye out, knocked it out. Evid, you'd say, you go free with that. My time, mechusar Abraham, because now you have made him missing a limb. Or what the Gemara is saying here, and it's going to prove it in a second, is that even though until now we've said the definition of knocking out an Aver is that it loses its function, over here the Aver already lost its function. But despite that fact, you can still go free because he removed the Aver completely, which is basically saying that there's another step. This is an even higher form of damage, which is not just losing function, but removing it completely. And how do I know that? V'tani tuna. Because we have a tana that tells us, tamut v'zachrut bebehema. When it comes to animals, there's a demand that they be no mumim, tam, that they be complete, zachrut, and there's a demand that they be males, meaning that there's a difference between a male and a female. Vein tamut v'zachrut belfot. That is not true by birds. By birds, you don't have to have them be tamim, they can have mumim in them, and it doesn't matter whether they are male or female. And that is because of the psukim, which bring down by Kabanot, it says, ish ish mi beit yisrael sheyakrib kurbano b'chol nedreem, lirtzonchem tamim zachar, babakar, baksavim, ubaizim, And so over there it says, by the behemot, Tamim and Zachar. So the Gemara learns out of that that the Tamim and Zachar is relevant by animals, it's not relevant by Ofot. That means when you bring a Tor or Ben Yonah for a Korban, you can bring a male or a female, we're indifferent between them, and also can have Mumim. There's no problem. Yochol Yavsha Gafa. Maybe if its wing dried out. Vnikta aragla, or one of its legs was missing. Nechteta eina, or one of its eyes was poked out, removed completely. Tamalomar mina of. Not all ofot are good. Minof, only some of the ofot are good. Below kolof, not all of. And what's the difference? The difference is between whether it's a mom or mechusar eiver. If it's missing a limb, then it's pasul to go on the mizbeach. If there's just damage or a mum on it, that is not enough of a reason to not put on the mizbeach or disqualify it from the mizbeach. What you see here is that there's an incremental step from loss of function or mum and mechusar eiver. The mechusar eiver is a higher level of loss than simply just not being functional. And so you learn that out from the Korbanot, as Tosfo points out of here. Why don't we learn that out? We've known this in Gemara in Avodah Zarah, says that Bnei Noach do not have a din of mumim by Korbanot, but they do have a din of mechusar eiver. So why don't we just learn it out of Bnei Noach? It brings a drusha that whenever the Torah mentions something before Matan Torah, if it's repeated again after Matan Torah, that means that it's applicable to Bnei Noach before Matan Torah. If the Torah never repeats the din, that means that it's only a din for Klal Yisrael, not Bnei Noach. So for instance, Gidon Asheh. Gidon Asheh is mentioned by Yaakov Avinu in Sefer Bereishit. It's never mentioned again in the Torah. So how do we know it applies to Jews? That's the rule, because it was said before Matan Torah, not repeated after Matan Torah, means it's only Shayach Yisrael. On the other hand, items like not killing, which is mentioned both before Matan Torah and after Matan Torah, that means since it's mentioned after Matan Torah, that means that's the Jewish command. That means that not killing before Matan Torah is the Bnei Noach command. The problem with Chusar Eiver is that if the Torah did not repeat it or give us a drusha by the Israelim, we would assume it only applies to Israel, not Bnei Noach. Therefore, I need Mina Of to teach me it applies by Bnei Israel. And that means that the Mechusar Eiver that is mentioned before Matan Torah, that is even for Bnei Noach. The Bnei Noach have a restriction against Mechusar Eiver. You could argue here, just as a side, that this is unique to Korbanot, because there's a specific pasuk, which is, if you bring me pechatcha, if you bring from your disgusting stuff, ayir to Hashem, will Hashem want it? Meaning that the Mechusar Eiver makes it so lowly that it's not appropriate to bring it before Hashem. And that's a specific soul by Korban, but may not apply by an Ebed. The fact that the Gemara extends from one to the other is interesting over here, and doesn't say this is a unique din by Kodashim, which you could clearly say over here. So Amar Bechir Ba'ash, Yamar Rav, Haitalo, Yeteret. If he has an extra limb, Vichotcha, and the Adon cuts it off, Ebed Yosei Ba'an Lecherut. The Ebed goes free because you ruined the limb. So for instance, if he has six fingers, and you cut off that sixth finger, he will go free, because that's one of the Roshei Varim. This goes to the Gemara in Bechorot, which tells us with regards to Mumim, that when you have an extra Eiver, if the Eiver is on plane with the other Eivarim, it is considered to be not a Mum, but just an extra finger. So if you have six fingers, and the six fingers on the same plane as the other five fingers, that's not a Mum, that's just like a Superman, he's got an extra finger. On the other hand, if the extra finger is not on plane with the other fingers, then it's considered to be a mum. So just, that'll be the same case over here, just in reverse. So if the Eved has an extra finger that's on plane with the other fingers, then it's not a mum. And if the Adon cuts it off, then that's cutting an Eved off and he goes free with it. Then if it's not on plane with the other fingers, it's a mum. So then if the Adon knocks it off, it was already a mum beforehand. He didn't do anything incremental by cutting off the finger. And that'll be the difference between these two cases. So that's the same way it works by Bechorot, that it is considered a mum or not considered a mum, will have the reverse impact over here, which is that if it's not a mum over there, then it will allow the Eved to go free if you knock it off. Or if it's considered to be a mum over there, if you knock it off or cut it off over here, it will not be grounds for freedom. Okay, we're going to stop here by the two dots on the top of Chaf Hei Amud Aleph.